Well, hello, good afternoon, and welcome to the program. This is the Becky Book Show. I'm Dr. Robin Gould, and you are here for a couple hours with me today as we talk about some of the things that pertain to Becky Books. And I'm very excited that you, if you're new especially, that you're listening to us today and that you're here, and I say us because I represent all of the authors of the Becky Books. So if you're not familiar with Becky Books, let me get you up to speed about who I am and what Becky Books are about. So first of all, I'm Dr. Robin Gould, and I am a licensed marriage and family therapist, and I have a doctorate in religious education, and I'm one of the authors of the Becky Books. And Becky Books, B-E-K-Y, it stands for Building and Encouraging the Kingdom of Yeshua. And this is a group of female authors that have used their study and their intuition and all of the things that help women be nurturing guides to write these books. And we've come together and we've picked topics that are commonly riddled with questions and a lot of misunderstandings and even subject to a lot of myths. And so we try to provide a resource in these small books to provide help for you, a resource for you to hand out to friends and family, even to use for yourself, especially if you're new. And even if you're seasoned, the books each cover a topic and we go in depth with each topic. And we do a pretty good job. You're not going to find mistakes or things that haven't been vetted or verified by original sources. So they're very helpful books. And if you're seasoned, there's still a lot of people that send me a lot of mail and messages that they learned something they thought they knew and actually didn't know because they hadn't quite expanded the scope of their study, as the Becky Books tend to do. So sometimes I have Becky Book authors on here and we talk about like a particular book. Sometimes I cover my own books, and sometimes we talk about something that's just related to Becky Books. So we broaden the scope even more of what the book covers based on the needs of the people, because we hear from the people. We hear the questions that they're asking. I read this book and I had this further question. So that was today for us. That's what our show is going to be about today. I'm going to talk about some of the frequently asked questions that people ask me after reading my Becky Books. And so if you've read my Becky Books, I have four, and my latest one is First Century Words Revealed to 21st Century Believers, Analyzing the Dietary Laws. And that is a part of a trilogy of books. The other one is called Colossal Controversies, and the other one is called Peter's Vision, Beacon or Bacon. And those three books basically run through the gamut of the main questions about the dietary laws, and that's what those three are meant to do together. They work really well together. One refers to the other. And then I wrote another book called Divorce and Remarriage in the Bible, and we all know what a hot topic that is and continues to be. So, there's a phone. Apologize for that. Okay, sorry about that. Not that that's distracting. So anyway, what we're going to talk about today is some of the questions that people submit and say, well, I read your book and I had this further question. And I've heard kind of these same questions similarly from people repeating these questions. So I wanted to go into those today. We were going to do it last week, but after the Women of Valor Conference, I had a lot of requests to cover some of the material that we talked about there. And I just had enough requests that I went off target, and instead of doing the frequently asked questions as I posted, I wanted to cover that material. Had some people that were going out of country and they just wanted to hear it before they left. So anyway, we're going to cover some of these frequently asked questions. So just to reiterate my background is that I am a marriage and family therapist. So if that gives you any idea, my specialty is all about attachment and about relationships. So every time I do any speaking, I'm always speaking from the perspective of relationship. And today will be no different. We're going to talk about the questions that people ask, and I'm going to answer them in terms of relationship. Because the covenant of Hashem, of Adonai, of God, is actually just about relationship, a relationship he desires with us and a relationship we desire with him. And of course, this relationship will occur on his terms because he is the creator of the universe. He knows how it works and he knows how it's supposed to continue working. So we submit to him out of trust and out of love and out of acknowledging He is extremely intelligent. He is the intelligent designer, and he is the one who knows. So let's just move on to what these questions are, because, you know, a lot of people, and you know this, if you're new, you generally know that people will kind of approach the topic of the Torah, which is something that we teach about in our Becky books, is that people look at it as a covenant of bondage. And it's been sort of, I'm going to say, presented on a plate and digested that way for many, many years, that it's a covenant of bondage. Through mistranslations, misunderstanding, misdoctrines, just all kinds of things where people had gone wrong in the language and in the tone of what was being written. So we're talking about marriage. We're talking about a marriage covenant. So I'm always going to come at this from a standpoint of relational covenant. And what do we consider bondage in a relationship? So I want to just make this point. Okay, so that's one of the top things that I hear. Is that, but I thought, and if you're a seasoned and you know this stuff, stick with me because we're going to probably get into something you might not have covered. But I want to ease into what we're doing today. But people have, you know, said, but I was always taught that the Torah is a yoke of bondage. It's a covenant of bondage. So if you're not looking at the covenant as a marital covenant, which I firmly believe, and most people that, you know, read into the Hebrew believe, and who understand about the bride and bridal covenants and everything, they believe that these are marital vows. So if you're saying that agreeing to the instructions put you at a disadvantage because you can never be perfect, which is the piggyback question that goes along with that, they say, well, it's a covenant of bondage because I can never be perfect, and that's why it's bondage. So if you've heard that, you've heard that many times. Here's a way to answer that. And if you are asking that question, I'm going to try to answer that for you and kind of help you out with that. So I want to liken it to marriage, okay? Remember, I'm a marriage therapist. So saying that, you know, if we agree to these instructions of the Torah, that we are at a disadvantage because we are certainly not ever going to be perfect, is actually like saying this about marriage. You know, you've heard people say this, marriage vows put you into bondage. You have people that are very anti-marriage. They believe that these vows put you into bondage. And because I won't be able to be perfect as a spouse, and I don't want to break promises that I make, I'm just not going to make any. So we can share our lives and live together. We'll be there for each other, but I'm not taking vows. I'm not getting married because marriage is a setup for failure. And that's sort of where the root of that question is that this covenant sets me up for failure. So it kind of underscores the view that person has of the Father, that he would set you up for failure, which is not the view I have of him. And I hope that I can challenge that view if you carry that view. But the verse that they use, where this question comes from, where the emails I get, they will talk about James 2:10. So if we're reading verse 10 here, This is what they use when they're asking this question. It says, for whomever keeps the whole law and yet stumbles at just one point is guilty of breaking all of it. So when you take that one line and you just pluck it out as a standalone verse, we're really reading it out of context and we're misrepresenting it because this would appear that the law is a setup for failure. Okay, so we can't just take one line and we can't, we can even take that one passage where it said Jesus wept and say that stands alone. And if you take that as it stands alone, he's a victim who never did anything. If you put it in context with the love he had for humans and for his Father, you would understand this was a weeping for the travesty of sin and for the passion he had and the love he had. So even that can be completely misconstrued. So I'm just using that as a very simple example. But let's read the whole thing. If we're going to put this in context, we're still in James. I want to go a little bit earlier. Okay, we're going to go to verse 8. James 2:8 through 11. Okay, so verse 8. So if you really keep the royal law found in Scripture, love your neighbor as yourself, you are doing right. But if you show favoritism, you sin and are convicted by the law as lawbreakers. For whoever keeps the whole law and yet stumbles at just one point is guilty of breaking all of it. For he who said, you shall not commit adultery, also said, you shall not commit murder. If you do not commit adultery, but you commit murder, you have become a lawbreaker. So if that is that helpful, I mean, when we go back, do you notice how different that is, right? Do you notice how when you put it in context, like, oh, I think I'm starting to understand that that's not exactly what it says. It doesn't just say I'm being set up for failure. So let's just analyze it a little bit more here, because the two sins that are being discussed here are adultery and murder. That's what they're talking about. They're not talking about a person being perfect and not having redemption or anything like that. They're talking about adultery and murder. So it's not saying that it's for, if the outcome of your question is, okay, so we don't do any of it because we might break some of it. So it's not saying that it's now permissible to disobey the instructions and commit these sins of adultery and murder. But it's saying that even if you aren't murdering, but are just committing adultery, you're guilty of being stained, period, by just sinning in general. So in other words, just because you're obedient in some or even most things, any sin makes you guilty and you're in a guilty status. You're in a non-innocent status. So it's not really a mystery that there's no such thing as good enough. And the only standard that the Father can accept is perfection, which is why he offers perfect atonement by his own life. So that really makes sense when you put it into perspective. So oftentimes I answer this question, it brings up another question. And that is kind of how anything goes with people. We have linked a lot of things together that don't go together. So, you know, here we are in James, and then this often leads to a question in Galatians. So it's, here we are, into a letter to the people of Galatia after talking, about a historical account of James. So, but this is where it leads. It says, for all who rely on the works of the law are under a curse. For it is written, cursed everyone who does not abide by all the things written in the book of the law. So if that makes some sense there to you, how that can be misconstrued as another setup for failure. Now, the penalty Messiah paid removes the curse we deserve for breaking it, but it doesn't remove the law itself, right? And why would it? What it's saying is you can't rely on yourself. It's not saying dismiss the law. It's saying don't rely on yourself. You have help. So this perspective that would suggest that if you desire to abide by the whole law, you better do all of them or it doesn't count. Well, actually, that applies and always will. But this was not information given to impugn the law itself and discourage people from obeying it. It was actually to rebuke the thinking that good enough people could be saved without Messiah. Basically, they're saying you're not going to earn your way in because everyone has sins. Everyone has to be redeemed. So just to always kind of sprinkle this reminder in is that we have to really remember that from the beginning, we're given the first lesson that the Bible really teaches is that the adversary does not tempt us to obey the law. He tempts us to disobey the law. Okay, so just kind of keep that in your mind, because what's really being taught here, questions that I'm getting, what's really being taught is that if you sinned even only once in your past, which is probably not possible, but say you only even sinned once and you behave perfectly every day since then, still need the Messiah, because once you've broken even one law once, you've broken the whole covenant, because of course all goes together. So it's to invoke in you your admission that you need a Messiah, you need the Messiah. So, of course, that's no different for people that would call themselves the New Testament church. If you broke any, even one of the 1,050 New Testament commands, then that's the same story as if you broke one of the 613 Torah commands or the 220 or so that would apply to you as an individual. It's not every Torah law applies to each person. But if you break one, you're guilty of breaking it all. You're a sinner, just plain and simple. So we don't abandon the New Testament, right, because of this? No, we rely on the blood of Messiah. So it's not to discredit the instructions, in its purpose, it's to promote the Messiah, right? So it doesn't discredit the law, it promotes the Messiah. But they're not mutually exclusive, because the Messiah restores us back to covenant. He is not an alternative to the covenant, because by his blood, he redeems us back into it. So it's very important that this get corrected with people, because it's to correct people who had thought that obedience covered up the stains that they incurred by the sins they committed. Okay, because you remember, this was a lot of pagan and little g gods that people were coming out of, and they could make something up by doing something for that god, you know, like sacrificing a baby or just different things that they would do to make up for things. We don't rely on our own actions. We rely on the one action of Yeshua. So that's very, very different. And it's really important that we understand that. It's extremely important that we get that. Because when you trust the lawgiver, you trust his law, and you know he would never set you up for failure, ever. That is not going to happen. So if we are going to read this in proper context, we're going to see that the Torah is the Father's perfect enduring word, and the Messiah is his perfect plan of redemption all at the same time. And I think that's pretty. But let's jump back to Galatians. We're going to compare again, and I'm going to make an additional point, because this is where this line of questioning often goes. Okay, so we're going to get to, in Galatians, I believe this is 3, verse 12. We're moving on here. The law is not of faith. On the contrary, it says, the person who does these things will live by them. Christ redeemed us by the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us, for it is written, cursed is everyone who is hung on a pole or a tree. He redeemed us in order that the blessing given to Abraham might come to the Gentiles through Christ Jesus, so that by faith we might receive the promise of the Spirit. Okay, so we are on the same page here with what we're looking at. I want to look at this and I want to draw your attention to part of the sentence right here. This is the inflammatory sentence. The law is not of faith. Okay, so you hear that. The law is not of faith. So people think, well, that means that it's not even about faith. The law is about something legalistic, and it's nothing about our faith. Okay, but if you read it, it says, the law is not of faith. On the contrary, the person who does these things will live by them. Now, if you look in the Greek, in the linear, when it says of faith, right? Actually, the word there means out of. The law is not out of faith. It isn't an outcome of faith. The law isn't an outcome of faith. It says rather. So the word there that we're using for rather is actually most often translated as however. That's how it's most commonly used, however. So, and of course, the word for faith is more commonly translated as fidelity or faithfulness. Okay, so it's not this subjective idea of belief that we have in our Western society ascribed to the word faith. Actually an action of trust. Faith would be a trust. So fidelity to commit to, right? So remember, we're talking about a relationship. That's what's important. So what is being quoted here about the laws not of faith? Let's look at that, because that's going to help us keep it into context of how it's written. We're going to just take care of this one problem here, because it's a pesky one that comes up a lot. Well, actually, what's being quoted is Leviticus 18:4. And it's sent in a positive, not a negative. It's sent in a positive. It says, you must obey my instructions and be careful to follow my decrees. I am the Lord your God. Keep my decrees and laws, for the person who obeys them will live by them. I am the Lord. So here you have the Father describing how obedience leads to prosperity, not negative bondage and curses, right? So I want to insert a more commonly used and more accurate word contextually to this passage 12. 12, right? The law is not of faith, however, it says in Leviticus, that the law is not of faith, however, it says in Leviticus, the person who does these things will live by them. So it's more, if we're going to even more accurately, let me just actually even go one step further. The law is not out of fidelity, however, it says in Leviticus, the person who does these things will live by them. Does that make sense? So if it looks like the law is being contrasted with faith, the real root of that contrast is, and I'll paraphrase it, anybody who does these things will live by them, meaning that the law produces prosperous results every time. It says so in Leviticus, because they're the laws of the universe. So these laws are going to work, and I'm using air quotes here around the word work. They're going to work even for the atheist without faith or commitment to God. That doesn't mean the atheist is in covenant with God, right? And they're still under a curse because they've not been redeemed. Because this sort of trust is not about prosperity, right? It's about loving God, admitting your need for Him, which is a positive thing, not you're a horrible, worthless creature. It's you need Him. And you're having faith in what He provided to redeem you. Okay, so if a person reads about just the laws of soil, and you read about that, they compare that to the Sabbath laws about Sabbathing the land every 7 years, right? As the Torah teaches us to do. So even if you were an atheist agricultural specialist who, you know, cares not at all about the Father, you're going to see a better yield in your land if you followed these divine instructions. It's going to work for you because the nutrients being restored and your harvest is better. But that's not because you have trust and commitment to the Father. It's because you simply wanted a better harvest and the law produced results. That's the root of the contrast there. The law is not a faith. Whoever does it will live by it. They'll prosper. But we need redemption. Only redemption is by grace through faith. It's not that hard. Understand that. But when something is read over and over and taught over and over out of context, you're going to start having what we call a seared mindset where that's all. So when I'm reminding people that He's not looking for a bride sort of thing that's wanting results, but He wants a passionate exchange, the bride seeking Him and only Him. Okay? If you're not going to disagree with me, of course that's what He wants, but maybe you won't think it applies to what is being taught here in James and Galatians when it is. So it's very important to remember that this is about relationship and not just results. And that's basically the nutshell of what's being said in Galatians. This is about relationship, not just results. Follow the law because you will live. You will live. You will live. Don't think that this negates your need for the Messiah. So, very important that we wrap our minds around that, and maybe that helps you share that yes, obedience to the law does yield physical profit. But profiting from this behavior is not alone to be construed as a relationship Father, even if physical outcome is proven to be beneficial. That word outcome, that was in the Greek there. And we can just even by extrapolation, even go a little further and remember that neither is invoking the power of the name and thinking that that is enough. Because He says not everyone who comes to is going to he doesn't know them, right? He doesn't know them. So anyway, that's just something very interesting that I feel like is really important. And we need to remember that we're talking about who knows Him. So we're going to demonstrate our faith and our trust in His wisdom and authority. That's what faithfulness is. It's when we trust Him out of love and not just so we can prosper. So if I'm going to really paraphrase that even further, actually I've wrote out a paraphrase here. The law is not our guarantee of a relationship, although it's promised that when you obey it, you will thrive, at least in this physical realm, there is still the need to be allowed into the covenant. The Messiah fulfilled the requirement of our penalty, which means that we are all family, and it's our commitment to Him that makes us all one Messiah as heirs to the promises of the Spirit. So that's my paraphrase of what I feel like Galatians 3:12-14 is trying to say. So does that make sense? If that makes sense to you. So we can even go back further, and in Galatians 3, it says the righteous person will live with faithfulness, right? So here you have the word faithfulness, not just faith. So I think that's interesting, and I think that's really powerful to remember that. So we have to look at things properly. It's really important. And also remember that in Galatians 3:11, Paul is quoting Habakkuk. First, the righteous person will live by his faithfulness. So he's actually quoting about in Habakkuk, it's actually what the topic is they're quoting. It's about disobedience and how it's shameful, but the faithful one will live. So if you take this into context and you're connecting these dots, as readers of the Bible would have known that in the days that where things were seen clearly, the context is obvious, where obedience definitely benefits us. So it's not some way that we are supposed to just let things go. So this is often where people start getting into this whole law versus grace piece. And if you're not new, you've heard this probably quite a bit, that you have law versus grace, right? So I always call that the big mental myth that got through. It was just something that was so dumb that no one questioned that something could be that dumb. And they just believed it. I mean, that's just the way I look at it. And it's dumb for everyone, not just for if you believed it, you were dumb. It's just dumb, period. And it got through. It got through to the masses for hundreds and hundreds of years. So I don't want you to take any of that personally. I'm not going to take it personally. This is just something that we believe. So people are saying that they're obeying the law versus relying on grace. But these are two opposites. But it doesn't make sense, because an opposite is an opposite. There's an up and there's a down. It's not an up and then side, right? Those aren't opposites. Those aren't actual opposites. So obeying something, relying on something aren't opposite actions, okay? That is not an opposite. The root of the contrast that's being harped here in the Bible over and over, which is what we were talking about just already in our show, is not about the nouns law and grace. It's not about these nouns. It's about the verbs obey and rely. That's the contrast. Because nouns and verbs cannot be opposites of each other. Very, very simple. So a true opposite would be to obeying the law. The true opposite is breaking the law. Right? That's really, really simple. A true opposite to relying on grace would be not to rely on grace. That's a true opposite. So law and grace are not opposing nouns to each other anymore than obey and rely upon are as verbs. But when we read through a filter, the easy point just slips by, because we're actually not thinking. We're just reading through the mind of someone else who taught us something. Let someone else think. So we obey the law. So if we're going to put the opposites in motion, it's not obey the law versus obey grace, because you can't obey grace. Because grace never tells you to do anything, right? And if it did, it wouldn't be grace. And on the other side, relying on the law versus relying on grace, well, you can't rely on the law. We've already talked about that enough, because the law is not claiming to be your grace. It's claiming to benefit you, but it's not your redemption. So how could you rely on it as your redemption, right? Because it only claims to be the measuring stick to point out where you grace. So you obey the law and you rely on grace. So I think that is pretty powerful and simple, and yet can be very difficult for people to understand. But if you're reading these verses through a filter that sees the Father's law as a bad thing, rather than based on what he says, which is that is a good thing, you are going to misunderstand all these passages, because you're reading it through a biased filter. And you're telling it what to say, right? So if we put this into context with let's say, Abraham, because he's mentioned here in Galatians passage 6 here, Galatians 3, 6. It says, even so, Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. Therefore, be sure that it is those who are of faith who are sons of Abraham. The scripture, foreseeing that God would justify the Gentiles by faith, preached the gospel beforehand to Abraham, saying, of all the nations will be blessed in you. So then those who are of faith are blessed with Abraham, the believer. That's interesting. It says that the gospel was preached beforehand to Abraham, saying, all the nations will be blessed in you. That's really interesting. So let's read about Abraham's faith and the covenant that he received and what was credited to him, because this is about you, right? So you have the father speaking to Isaac. We're here going back into Genesis 25, passage 3, verse 3 through 5. And this is what he says. For lo, you and your descendants, I will give you all these lands and will confirm the oath I swore to your father Abraham. And I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky, and I will give them all these lands. And through your offspring, all nations on earth will be blessed. Because Abraham obeyed me and did everything I required of him, keeping my commands, my decrees, and my laws. So that's what it says about Abraham. It said he believed God. So he did what? Did he obey the law, or did he dismiss the law? Well, in Abraham's covenant, which is Genesis 26:5, Abraham kept my requirements, my commands, my decrees, and my laws. And then if we look in Deuteronomy 11, verse 1, the Sinai covenant, love the Lord your God, keep his requirements, commands, his decrees, and his laws. This is the precise way that this Sinai covenant is expressed in Deuteronomy. So you're really seeing these dots connected very closely. That's a buzzword that's going to hearken someone's ear to putting something together. We've not been taught to do that in the Western way that we read the Bible. Okay, we've just basically separated things into segments and into ideas and philosophies, and we haven't really put the book together. Abraham was a man of faith, so of course, obeyed the law, right? He was a man of faithfulness and of fidelity. So, if Abraham obeyed because he knew the gospel, and that's what it calls it, gospel, then he's an example of one who shows the law, as Jeremiah 31:33 would say, it's written on his heart. So this is the actual best example right now, as we're reading, about someone who said that he kept the law and a life of faith. So those things aren't separate. They go together. That's really, really exciting. I think that's really so. I'm wondering what questions you have. And if you have any questions further, just on that one meaty, thick, heavy portion we just went through, you can email me. I am at New Covenant Path. That's my website. It's www.newcovenantpath.com. And if you want to email me, you can, and ask questions, and we can talk about, you know, anything that you want to talk about. I can bring stuff up on the show. If you have ideas, feel free to do that, because I am very interested in, you know, Abraham is just a fascinating topic, and a lot of people have a lot more questions about Abraham. I can't answer every question, but I probably can point you to someone that has a resource that will help you. So I think it's interesting when you think about the faith of Abraham from a messianic perspective. If you actually go, and I'm thinking here, it's Genesis 22, and if you can turn here to Genesis 22, and I think this is, let's start. Verse 2 here. Okay, he says, now take your son, your only son who loves Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering. Right? So you remember that part? You get to verse 4. Of course, Isaac splits the wood, and they go up. They get told to go. It says in verse 4, on the third day, Abraham lifted his eyes and saw the place from a distance. Very interesting. about that sentence is really a Hebrew idiom of lifting your eyes. It's like you're seeing ahead and you're seeing a place from a distance on the third day. So third being the number of resurrection. So the gospel was preached to Abraham. Well, what's this whole idea that Abraham is a messianic figure in terms of what he saw, especially because he lifted his eyes, he saw the future on the third day, and he saw, I believe, that resurrection. And he knew that the promises would occur through Isaac, that through Isaac, his descendants would be blessed. So there's a lot of really interesting stories and ideas, and I love all of them about Abraham and the binding of Isaac. That whole thing is so interesting. I've heard fascinating relational ideas and Hebrew word studies on it. And I'm not sure exactly, but I can say that you know that Abraham was not committing human sacrifice, though some people believe that Sarah was grieved over the misunderstanding Abraham had, and I think that's a compelling theory. But I would also say, I think he knew that, because it said that he believed he was a man of faith. He lifted his eyes and he saw on the third day the place from distance, which is where the resurrection occurred. And that he did believe that he was a man of faith. So I think that's really interesting. And also Abraham says, God will provide for himself the lamb for the burnt offering. And of course, then what happens is there's a ram. But Abraham on the third day, he saw the lamb. I think that's exciting and very interesting. But it's important to know these things. These are some basic truths that have been sold to us as basic doctrines in a whole different package. And we are just unpacking that now. We're unwrapping this for you to see it for what it is. Basically, I like to say that we're taking things out and we're bringing them in there. We're putting them in the light and we're seeing what it really said. Not through a seared doctrinal mindset, not through a biased filter. We're not reading it to make it say what someone told us it said. We're actually reading it word for word and putting it with the sages and all the wisdom and the Hebrew language and Hebrew idioms and the different things that we're learning that are so important as elements of study. And we're seeing it almost through brand new eyes for so many people. And so it can be a challenge. What? Challenge is good. It causes us to grow. It causes us to move forward. And I know that you can do it because I know you can do all things through the Messiah who gives you his strength to do it. And he has never failed. He has not failed me. He will not fail you. He will never leave you nor forsake you. So I encourage you to continue to listen as we go through these frequently asked questions. And I am going to take a short break now, let you go grab yourself a beverage to come back, and we're going to go through some more meaty portions and get some great information. So come back soon. Hello, welcome back. I'm glad you're here. I'm excited to continue what we're talking about here, which is frequently asked questions that people have that kind of push our books to a wider limit and to discuss some of the things that crop up for the average and the above average people that want to know more about the Word of God. And so that's what we're talking about. So now we're going to move on to this idea of the mixed multitude and to whom the law was given. So this is a really important question because we want to know to whom the law was given. It's very important. So we're going to turn to Numbers 15, 14 through 16. Okay, so here's what it says. It says, the community is to have the same rules for you and for the alien living among you. This is a lasting ordinance for the generations to come. You and the alien shall be the same before the Lord. The same laws and regulations will apply both to you and to the alien living among you. So, and the word alien there is used when you look at that in the Hebrew, it's standing for the person that has grafted in, right? The person who like Ruth, has not opted to just pass through and take a sort of a noteworthy interest and then move on. But they have joined, right? And they're calling them an alien, not because they consider them aliens anymore, because they actually have committed them to the covenant. But it's like if you consider your adopted child as much your child as the birth children you have, and you say the adopted child and the birth child are all part of the same household, it doesn't mean that they're any less of a part of the household. It means that they're the same. So in this case, you're going to have the native and the alien being seen the same. So either the alien is viewed as a native, or the native is viewed as an alien. And that's Numbers 15, 14 through 16. So if we're going to look at it, I want to take this a little further, and I want to look at what was the word used in the New Testament for this mixture of native-born and foreign-born believers. That's what's really important when we're doing our study, is we need to put things together in context. So we're going to actually fast forward ahead, because often the root of the question that we're talking about right now, about who does this law apply to, people ask me about Acts 6 and 7, and we're talking about Stephen, because Stephen is referring to this group. A lot of people don't connect Acts 6 and 7 with Numbers 15, okay? But actually, they do go together, and this is why. In Acts 6 and 7, Stephen actually refers to this group. So he is going to point us in the direction of understanding this, because he knows what he's talking about, because he was a scholar and actually a martyr, as we know. So in Acts 6 and 7, let's set it up so we know what the context of his words are. He was being falsely accused of teaching that people no longer have to obey the law. So that's what they were saying. They were accusing him of suggesting that any part of the Torah would be unapplicable. So Stephen here is defending his position that he would never teach that believers in the Messiah are not commanded to obey the law. That's what he's doing here. And he refers to this group, and I want to look at the word he uses here in Acts 6, 11 through 13, and I quote, "Then they secretly persuaded some men to say, 'We have heard Stephen speak words of blasphemy against Moses and against God.' So they stirred up the people and the elders and the teachers of the law, and they seized Stephen and brought him before the Sanhedrin. They produced false witnesses who testified that this fellow never stopped speaking against this holy place and against the law." So on to verse 14, stay with me. "For we have heard him say that this Jesus of Nazareth will destroy this place and change the customs Moses handed down to us." So Stephen speaks, and here's what he says. He says, "This is the one who was in the congregation in the wilderness with the angel who spoke to him at Mount Sinai and with our fathers. He received living oracles to give to us." That's Acts 7:38. Now the word he uses is congregation. So congregation, of course, in the first century writings in the New Testament, ecclesia, is translated throughout as the word church. So if the congregation is the church, remember what Stephen said. Where did Stephen say the church was? In the wilderness and at Mount Sinai. So ecclesia, if you look up the proper definition, it means an assembly of human beings for a specific purpose. So this is the word used to describe the church in the New Testament. That's the word. Now, the Hebrew equivalent for this term is kohal, and I'm not pronouncing that right, I'm sure, but it's defined as a gathering for a specific purpose. It's a gathering called for a specific event purpose. Now, let's be very clear here that there is absolutely no warrant from any scholarly linguistic interpretation for inconsistently translating you'll see it as church in some places, and then translating it as congregation in others. So Stephen is not actually speaking about the congregation in the wilderness. He is speaking of the ecclesia, the called out gathering, and that is the word church. So this word is the same word that you're going to read when they use it as the word church in Ephesians, Corinthians, and Romans. So let's use it with consistency here. So let's go back. Let's look at this. So Stephen says, this is the one who was in the church in the wilderness, the angel who spoke to him at Mount Sinai with our fathers. He received the living oracles to give to us. So that was, remember those Acts 7:38. Now let's see if this fits with the Torah's account. Let's go back and connect this. We're going to connect this, right? So we're actually going to even go from Numbers to Acts, now to Deuteronomy. And we're on Deuteronomy 29:9-15, and I quote, carefully follow the terms of this covenant so that you may prosper in everything you do. All of you are standing today in the presence of the Lord your God, your leaders and chief men, your elders and officials, all the men of Israel, together with your children and your wives and the aliens living in your camps who chop your wood and carry your water. You are standing here in order to enter into a covenant with the Lord your God, a covenant the Lord is making with you this day and sealing with an oath to confirm you this day as his people, that he may be your God as promised you and he swore to your fathers. Now look, we're bringing in, we're tying in our previous segment here, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, right? And that's what's meant as the fathers are these patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I'm making this covenant with its oath, not only to you who are standing here with us today in the presence of the Lord your God, but with those who are not here today. We have been reading about those grafted in are heirs of Abraham's blessings. That they are heirs. They are heirs. You see how that all connects perfectly? You can't separate them out. So the mainstream definition of the church, which would be defining it as being limited to these new Gentile converts from the first century onward, right? That's what they're saying it is clearly not the Bible's definition of the word church, which defines it as those receiving the written law of Moses and all believers. So, therefore, it's actually only biblically consistent, if you consider yourself the church, to understand that you were part of that group that was receiving the Torah in the desert. And that's what the Bible defines as the church. I think that's so interesting. That all works together so well. I mean, it really does. It works together exactly right. And it reminds you that the Torah isn't just for us. It's about us, right? This book is about us. It's a very important thing that we remember this and that we can share this with people. Inclusion is so important to people. They want to attach to a loving God who's beckoned them. And we are vessels of that attachment. We are vessels of that courtship and of that proposal. So we can really understand why, without being confused, in Matthew 15:24, Messiah says, I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Right? These are not separate groups. So very often at this point, and this almost exclusively happens every time I do a speaking engagement on these more rudimentary ideas, but this is where people get into this question about, but isn't there a new covenant? I've always learned that there is a new covenant. Well, yes, there is a new covenant. But generally, few people actually really understand what this means because they have just been taught through a biased filter. So we'll look at where we read about the new covenant. Where's the first place we see it? As we see it in Jeremiah 31, and then it's quoted, Jeremiah is quoted in Hebrews 8. Okay, so what we have to establish is first where we hear about it, which we just did, and second, with whom is the new covenant to be made? So who is the group this covenant is said to be made? Okay, let's look at Jeremiah 31, and it's 31 through 34, and get that, so get there, and I'm going to quote it. The days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the people of Israel and the people of Okay, so the new covenant is discussed. And who is it made with? The people of Israel, the people of Judah. Very clearly. Hebrews repeats this. And we're in Hebrews 8, getting to 7:13. And he says, "For if that first had been faultless, then should no place have been sought for a second. For finding fault with them, he said, Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with you, who the people of Israel and the house of Judah." Isn't that interesting? Now, verse 9 gets interesting here in Hebrews. And I know there are people that believe that Hebrews is a spurious book. And this is one of their arguments, is that there's a misquote or a diverging off the point from Jeremiah. Because here's what it says. It says, "Not according to the covenant which I made with your fathers in the day when I took them by the hand to lead them out of the land of Egypt, because they continued not in my covenant, and I regarded them not." When actually it says in Hebrews, it says, "even though I was a husband to them." So is it a misquote that makes you want to throw the book out? Or is he making a point where he's saying, he's referencing that divorce, that he no longer regarded them, that he was a husband to them, but then divorced them? So that's going to be your call. But And I'm not going to weigh in because people get very upset either way. But I will say that I don't abandon the book of Hebrews. But it's not really a book. It's a letter. But I will say that it would make sense, since there was a divorce, that quote would be interrupted based on a new action. "For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel in after those days." Okay, so after those days, he's going to put it in their mind and write it on their hearts, and I will be to them their God, and they shall be my people. And they shall not teach every man his neighbor and every man his brother, saying, Know the Lord, for all shall know me, from the least to the greatest." So you're getting some clues about that new covenant. When is that new covenant made, and to whom? Well, to the house of Israel and the house of Judah, at a time when he's going to put the Torah in their minds, write it in their hearts, and no one's going to have teach anybody anything, because everybody will know that he is God, from the least of the least. So yes, there is a new covenant. But does it sound like we're in those conditions now? I mean, I'm sharing and speaking here on the radio for people that are learning this stuff. They're still teaching. There's still people that don't understand. So obviously this is a future event. And, you know, we're not going to find one single scripture, and Rico does excellent work, Rico Cortez, does some really great studies where he really shows you, you will not find one single scripture where the Father made a covenant with any Gentile nation. You can't find it. You can look and look. His only covenant is with Israel. But what he did was he beckoned Gentiles out of the nations to come into his covenant and to be grafted into Israel. That's how they would come out among them and be separate. If that makes sense. And, he, you know, you can learn even more on this topic from Rico, who does a great job talking about how the letter to Hebrews is actually only about the priesthood and the Yom Kippur atonement. So it's not about anything else. It's nothing to lay as a template on other information. It's really, really important. So anyway, so another part of this, and I just want to mention this, just because this always comes up, is people say, well, that in Hebrews, it describes a flawed covenant. That's what they say, because they read, "For if that first had been faultless, there would be no occasion to sought for another." Okay, so what was wrong with covenant? Well, actually, it doesn't say that the covenant itself was faultless, flawed. That's not what it says. So what it says is, if that first had been faultless, there would be no occasion sought for a second. So, because he found fault with them, he says there's going to be a new covenant in the future, because he found fault with them. Okay, so the fault didn't lie with the covenant. It lied with the covenant breakers. Now, the Father was not the covenant breaker. He didn't find fault with himself or his covenant. He found fault with him. Okay, so so let's just say this. They're saying that there's a better covenant. I want to talk about the word faultless too. I've covered that in other programs, but I'll mention it briefly. But first, he sought another covenant that was better. Okay, so that's where people get very tripped up here. It says, if he did that, then how could he also have said this and meant it when he says, I will never break my covenant? Okay, so he himself never broke covenant. So let's look at the word faultless. Okay, so the word faultless, people think that means flawed. Or if the first hadn't been flawed. But the word faultless is referring to the type of covenant it was, right? So it was a fault, like if you think of like a faultless divorce, no one's blaming anybody. They just want to be separated and their union dissolved. Well, that's not how our Father works. He doesn't just decide he doesn't want to be with us because he just doesn't want to be with us. He found fault. It wasn't a faultless covenant. It wasn't like the Genesis covenant where he made a promise just based on his own namesake that he wouldn't drown the earth again when he saw the bow in the sky. He would keep his promise. That was not based on any actions up by humans at all. That wasn't a faultless covenant. If it had been, he wouldn't have gotten another. He wouldn't have divorced them after finding fault with them. They couldn't have been at fault because it was a promise only held to him. He found fault with them. So it's just important to remember that he found fault with them. So what he's saying, if I'm actually going to paraphrase it, I'm going to nutshell it for you. I did not break covenant. If this was an unconditional covenant or a faultless covenant, I would have continued in it, but they broke it. Me, however, you can trust. Doesn't that sound a lot more like the Adonai, you know, right? He's actually reminding us here that he is faithful to his word always, not that his covenant was something that we could lose faith in. Okay, so he's not here telling us that his covenant was imperfect. He's actually telling you that he is perfect. So very important piece there for that. So that's pretty interesting. The new covenant is a big topic where people get very confused and super emotional. Like people are really pretty emotional. They kind of go into Hebrews here. They get very upset because it says that in Hebrews 6, it says, but now he hath obtained a more excellent ministry. How much also is he the mediator of a better covenant, which was established on better promises? And this is where people will parlay that into a new covenant, having different terms, right? But there's the New Testament terms where you can eat all the pork you want. You can, you know, you don't have to keep the Sabbath, all of these different ideas, because they're saying that there's a different covenant with different terms. Now, what people are erroneously thinking is that the word promises is akin to the word commandments. There you go. You actually have to know the language. The word promises, and I'm not even going to try to, well, apagilia is what I'm seeing. But these promises are referring to the intended limits of the Levitical priesthood, which is promised in a way of a picture of atonement, but not real atonement, right? That's a promise, right? Now, a commandment, entelei, that's how it's said, is for the word commandments. This refers to Adonai's definition of obedience, his ways that we are to follow. So Hebrews doesn't challenge this. This isn't about different better commandments that are more heartfelt. It's about different promises. It's Levitical limits is there's a promise where with Yeshua, it's done. So it's the same terms, but better promises. So I think that's really interesting. I like talking about that. I think that's really something that people need to think about. And a lot of times people don't think about that. Because throughout the New Testament, you're actually going to be, you're reading in your Bible all these letters that were written to the followers of the Messiah. And they were written by people who were native Judites, so they were Jewish. They were sent to many that weren't born Jewish, were sometimes called Gentiles. And they were new to this Torah lifestyle, and they had really just abandoned worship of these little g gods, right? So in letters is a lot of warning against thinking that obedience to the instructions is for justification, which was the case with these former gods who demanded sacrifice and works to be valued. And if you listen to any of my programs before, we talk about the difference between justification and sanctification. So justified is when you're redeemed only by the blood of the Lamb. Sanctified is when you're set apart by the commandments. The commandments don't justify you, they sanctify you. So you're set apart from the profane by sanctification. So the commandments are sanctifying. So if the commandment says don't steal, and you encounter something you want, you opt not to steal it, you obeyed the commandment, and the commandments sanctified you or set you apart from the profanity of stealing. So you were set apart by the commandment. Now, if you had stolen and you've repented, made restitution, you're redeemed by the blood. So you're justified by the blood. So important to just kind of keep that in the back of your mind that justification and sanctification are very different things. So these letters are often misinterpreted for a few reasons, right? Number one, a lot of people haven't learned the difference between justification and sanctification. They don't know. That's for you to share with them, right? And that's a very important piece. They somehow thought that the law did formerly save people. That's the other reason that letters are misunderstood. People don't even know they believe that. Do you know that if you ask somebody that, and not in a challenging, mean way, of course, you don't want to do that, but ask somebody, did you ever have it in your mind that the law did formerly save people? Now, this belief contradicts their actual correct view that the Messiah is the only salvation, right? The only way back into covenant is through that. But they don't know they even believe that. Because when you learn through a biased theology, a filter, you don't even know what you're thinking. That's very common. I went through a lot of that. The third reason that these letters are often misinterpreted, or it's very common reason, is they think that Israel and the church are two separate groups. Even though you're not going to say it wasn't Israel at Mount Sinai, but they are called the church. So you're seeing a link between the front half of the book and the second half of the book, the back of the book and the front of the book match. But if you don't know that, you're going to misinterpret. And you're going to separate these groups and think that there's a whole different set of agendas for one group than another. And a lot of times, people have actually never really read or know what God said about the purpose of the law and how he delights in it, like we read about in Deuteronomy. We've done that in a lot of programs that I've done, so I won't redo it now. But he talks about how the nations will view us, obey his law, see the result of it, and think, wow, a God who's doing, and he's close to me. And the other reason, I would say the fifth main reason why people misinterpret these letters and why we're having these frequently asked questions show, because they've not learned the history of the Old Testament to see what prophecies are scheduled to be fulfilled in respect to the restoration of the kingdom, so that you're not getting, you're not really understanding that the kingdom has to be restored. And they said, is this the time you're going to restore the kingdom of Israel? Are you going to put the family back together? If you don't understand that family was split apart, you won't understand the need for them to get back together. So this, of course, this information, once you know it, changes everything about the way that you view Bible and everything that you're reading. So that's a lot of information. Like I said, even for seasoned people, it kind of gives you an idea of the weight of the information to share with people and how much they need to hear. One thing leads to another. One question leads to another question. One biased theology was holding hands with another one. And it's a link of disaster that we have to basically unlink one hand at a time very carefully as friends, right? We come as friends because these are the days of Elijah. And if you think about how many times sat in a church or stood in a church and sang that song, we never really thought of the lyrics, right? And if you ever go back and listen to that song and really hear the prophetic implication of restoration of the kingdom and of being restored, the temple restored, days of Moses. I mean, this is amazing, that song. And rampant in churches and really not even at understanding what they're saying. And if you actually go into Malachi, Elijah's mentioned in context of these last day prophecies. So often people say, well, I don't really understand. Why is this information just coming to my ears now? Why am I, and this is actually my chronic lament that I had for years. Why would I know something better than millions and millions of scholars thousands of years? Why do I know this now? But if you actually go back and look in Malachi 22 to 24, and it's actually means my messenger, you get this last admonition of this last prophecy and this last warning to be taken into the hearts of Israel that they are told. It's this thing the Father says for all those who desire his covenant. Okay, and it's in Malachi, and it's about the context of his return and restoration of the kingdom. It says, behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. Remember you the Torah of Moses, just like in that song, my servant, which I commanded unto him in Horeb for all Israel, both statutes and judgments. So something new, even though it's something old, it's happening in a new way. So there's an old thing happening. And that's why this information is coming to these people and maybe coming to you. You can assure them that they have not been off track. And that's one of the biggest problems we have when people are speaking and sharing. They are so busy proving how right they are and how wrong the other people are that the people can't hear that they weren't supposed to know yet. That it was by the grace of God, the scales fell off our eyes and they are having their opportunity now. This is exciting. This is telling people the good news. And so an old piece of information is being made new to people to give us an idea of where we are in that prophetic time clock. We are before that coming great dreadful day. And a new thing is in the hearts of people. New information. So it's not about how wrong people have been and how they missed it. And oh my goodness, if we spent our life harping on what we've missed, we will never gain what there is to gain. We will continue to defend our mistakes rather than embrace our new knowledge, our new information, our new wisdom. Very important that we have that tone with people, because Elijah's message was returned to the old Torah. So if they're just learning this now, they're right on track with the way it was prophesied to be. Isn't that interesting? Doesn't that help you? It really helps me. It helps me share with people. I like to actually bring that up. Speaking, I'd recommend this to you. I do this. The first thing I do is I want to disarm my audience and into thinking that I am just this completely intelligent, perfect speaker who thinks they know everything, or who thinks they're perfect, who thinks they know everything, and who is so sorry that they didn't have it up until now. I'm actually trying to show them it's prophesied that they wouldn't. I might have found out before they did, but that doesn't mean anything. By a few years, right? In the big scheme of things, it's hardly any time. We're all part of that generation that's just learning, right? Even if I've been doing this since, I don't know, 2004, which really isn't that long, actually. And there are people that have been doing this for 40 years earlier than that, that's still within this realm of this generation, right? This is something where we even have sages yet, like that we can say are super, super sages. I definitely have people I look up to and learn from and sit at their feet. I definitely do. But people are not supposed to know this yet. All right. There's always been a remnant. Yes. There's always been a group that had both elements in their heart as a mixture of good and good. There always has been that. But that's important that when you speak, go into Malachi and say, why are you hearing this? Because this is your time to hear it. If you didn't know it before, that's fine. You weren't supposed to. It didn't happen. It wasn't supposed to happen. I'm hoping that piece is going to help this arm when you're speaking to people, when you're talking to your family, and they're like, what makes you so special that you know this information? You are privy to this information. Why did you know it? And why didn't the Roman church know for 1,000 years? Like, what makes you so special? Well, it's not so much that I'm special, even though we're all special. But it's about the prophetic timeline where it says this is going to happen. A newness comes on people of an oldness. Right? Doesn't that make sense to you? think it makes sense to me. And it helps. It's a way to be able to share with people in a disarming way. It doesn't hurt them. Because Ruth came in and she was a foreigner. She was an alien and she never tried to bring in something new, right? She just wanted to be a part. And if we're let's actually get to Ruth here. Let's quote her. We have Ruth 1:16-17. She says, "Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die. And there I will be buried. May the Lord God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything but death separates you and me." Talk about making a commitment, right? She didn't bring anything new. But through the good intentions of the mainstream church, they're saying, where you go, I'll go. I'm going to teach you the new stuff that the old people didn't know. You know, that's what they're saying. They think they're being really helpful by teaching, when really they need the information. They need the old stuff. They don't need to give the old people the new stuff, right? That's just something that we have grown to really understand. So far we've talked about some Galatians, about the law is not a faith and what prosperity benefits, but what faithfulness really is. We talked about the difference between law and grace. We connected some dots on Numbers. We went into Acts and connected that. I'm hoping it's starting to give you a picture of how connected this all is. We actually kind of study and let it lead to the next step, and you find out it was the same step, right? It was the same step, just in a different historical account. But they all kind of, they all definitely go together. We talked about the new covenant. What does that look like? What are the conditions present when that will be invoked? Right? That's a future event. We proved that because we read about it. We talked about law versus grace and how that's a myth. That's a mental myth, that these are not opposites, that they go together. And when we come back, we're going to talk about some stuff like under law. We're going to kind of briefly go over that. We're going to go into some of the other questions about the dietary laws that I don't have in my textbooks. Just a couple easy points that we didn't include in the books because they weren't very commonly referenced, but more and more I am getting emails and people have questions. So I thought it warranted, to survey it here on the show, and then we'll put it on the Becky Book page so that people can, on Facebook, so people can access it and learn from it. But so far I think we are covering some good ground, and it's a pretty meaty day, isn't it? Hope you brought your dental floss, because we're going to be keeping eating. We're going to get into Romans. We're going to get into Corinthians. We're going to get into Acts. We're going to talk about this. We're going to connect these dots for you so that hopefully it gives you a little idea of how to share this with your family and friends. It's not always easy. It's actually never easy. Well, I'm not going to say never, but it's very often not easy to share with family and friends. But if we can connect these dots with this treasure hunt, and you have Becky books to hand out, so you don't have to recreate the wheel, of course. But when the books have been read and people say, wow, this makes sense, let's talk more. I'm hoping that you're getting a few ideas here of how to share and how to connect these dots. So we're going to take a quick break. I'm Dr. Robin Gould here on the Becky Book Show. My website is www.newcovenantpath.com. Our Becky books are available on Amazon. Go on there and purchase them, and they're priced to sell. They're priced to be a very inexpensive resource. So we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to finish up our frequently asked questions on the dietary laws for the Becky books. So don't go away. Yes, welcome back. I'm glad you stayed with me for our last and final segment, where we're going to actually talk about three questions, three kind of topics about the dietary laws that we haven't covered in our Becky books. It didn't warrant its own book, but it does warrant talking about. So if you have your Bibles, I want you to turn to Romans. Let's get the letter here. A letter to the Romans, and we're at 14:1-2. Here's a common question that was less common than the other ones we covered, but it does warrant discussing now. Okay, let's read it. Romans 14:3-4, and I quote, "The man who eats everything must not look down on him who does not, and the man who does not eat everything must not condemn the man who does, for God has accepted him. Who are you to judge someone else's servant? To his own master he stands or falls, and he will stand, for the Lord is able to make him stand. Okay, so you can see where that might be a question for a person who's read through the filter of the dietary laws being abolished and done away with, and now we can eat everything we want because Yeshua said we could, which is not true. But let's read some prior verses to get some context, because that's the scripture that's often just kind of plucked out as a standalone to prove a point. And we are learning not to do that, right? So let's go on. I want to go to the passages before this to set up some context. And here's what it says. We start in verse 1. Accept him whose faith is weak, without passing judgment on disputable matters. Right there, we're getting our context. He is discussing disputable matters. Eating clean or unclean was not disputable. Keeping or breaking the Sabbath, not disputable. Right? Stopping at stop signs in this day and age is not disputable. When I say, when you drive, you know, you can play your radio or not play your radio. You can sing to yourself or not sing to yourself. That's disputable. You can, you know, you can wear high heels when you drive or not. These are disputable matters about driving. But a stop sign is not disputable. If you don't stop at the stop sign, people will die or could die. So they're talking about disputable matters. So then they go on to describe that. One man's faith allows him to eat everything. Now, disputable matters, that doesn't mean one man's faith says I can eat pork, so he eats it. That's okay. Nope, that's not a disputable matter. That doesn't qualify. But what things do qualify as disputable about food? Well, it tells us. It says another man whose faith is weak eats only vegetables. And I'm going to explain why the person who had the weak faith only ate the vegetables. Because this is where people might say, oh, I know a vegetarian. They must have very weak faith. Well, that's not what it's saying here at all. But here's what it says. It says another man whose faith is weak eats only vegetables. The man who eats everything must not look down on him who does not. And the man who does not eat everything must not condemn the man who does, for God has accepted him. Who are you to judge someone else's servant? To his own master he stands or falls, and he will stand, for the Lord is able to make him stand. Okay, so we've got some context, but let's look at this. So we've already discussed that eating unclean was an abomination and not a disputable matter. Okay, so this was not about unclean meat. We have to take that off the table, if you'll pardon the pun. Meat off the table. And, of course, the next verse tells us exactly what it is regarding. And this is about only eating vegetables, which is a disputable matter in the context of what we're talking about. Eating unclean meat is not a disputable matter. So that's not part of our equation here. So the problem is solved, and the Bible doesn't contradict itself. But there is an issue in this letter that has confused people. I'm going to clear it up. And it's actually a very glaring mistranslation. And it's a very big one because it misleads profoundly. So if we're going to Romans 14:14, I want to just talk about the word unclean here. In the King James Version, which is what some people consider to be a high standard version, this is the one place that in the King James Version that there's a mistranslation. It mistranslates the word koinos as unclean, when the actual word there is common. We talked about in Peter's vision. Please get Peter's vision, beginner bacon, and learn more about the difference between the words common and unclean. And that common can mean unclean, but it can also just mean disputable or regarded as unclean. I didn't mean the word disputable. I meant because I just used that word. Regarded as unclean, just an opinion. And then there is the actual word for unclean. So the actual word here is common. So it says in Romans 14:14, I know and am persuaded by the Lord Jesus that there is nothing unclean, but that's not the word of itself, because this is attached to what we just read, right? I'm just reading on in this passage, but I want to warn you before I read it that so it wouldn't undo everything we just had learned. It says, I know and am persuaded by the Lord Jesus that there is nothing unclean of itself, but really it's the word common. But to him that esteemeth it to be common, to him it is common. Okay, now if you're using the word unclean, you're thinking they are talking about unclean things. Like genuinely unclean things. And that your opinion esteems it as clean or unclean. That kind of harkens back to Timothy, where it's like, just give thanks and it's fine. Which we talked about in First Century Words. You can go ahead and check that out in that Becky book. But since you know that the word common means, now you're going to know that the word common is the word that was used in this verse, and you're going to read this passage entirely differently. Okay, so this is an indisputable fact. I'm not making this up. You can please get this yourself. But here in Romans 14:20, reading on, it says, do not destroy the work of God for the sake of food. All food, and the word there is broma, which is defined as allowable foods by Jewish law. Okay, that was the definition of food. But it is wrong for a man to eat anything that causes someone else to stumble. It's better not to eat meat or drink wine or to do anything else that will cause a brother to fall. So whatever you believe about these things, keep between yourself and God. Blessed is the man who does not condemn himself by what he approves. But the man who has doubts is condemned if he eats, because his eating is not from faith. And everything that does not from faith is faithfulness, right? Anything that isn't adhering and committing to commandments. Okay, so let's go back, because this can get you might be in the weeds right now, and that's okay. We're going to go back. First of all, what was the topic? It was about eating only vegetables, okay, about food. It was not about unclean meats, and Paul didn't consider unclean meat food, so no, we're not talking about that. And did he believe that all food that was created and set apart to be good for food was clean? Well, yes. Just we have to establish that he does believe that. If food was set apart to be good for food, like a chicken, right, that's clean. Okay. But in the context of this letter, all the way through this letter, in this discussion, they are discussing passing judgment on people on the topic of things that are common, of food restrictions, that's actually not found in the Torah. Right? So they even talked about drinking wine. So this is not Paul correcting those obedient to the law. He's correcting those who are dogmatically imposing personal conscience as the law. Right? There are people that will give you their opinions about what you should or should not be doing or drinking, whether you should or should not be drinking wine, whether you should or should not drink coffee. That is not, those are disputable matters. But we're being told not to bicker about disputable matters. So since eating unclean is not a disputable matter, and I mean, just go into Leviticus 11 and you're going to see it's at least 8 times. This consumption of things that were in the unclean category is classified as an abomination. Okay, so you can go look at other things that he classifies as an abomination and compare that. So anyway. If that's hard for you to understand socially, don't worry if you can't reconcile that, because you don't have to, because you're not God. So you can just take that burden right off you. So anyway, just important to put things into perspective about, this was about a person eating vegetables and not choosing meat. And we're going to learn more too in the next thing that we're going to talk about when we turn to 1 Corinthians 10. 23 through 27. When we go there, we're going to actually even make some more connections here. And we're going to understand more about this culture of this time frame. So turn to 1 Corinthians 10, 23 to 27. And we're going to connect a couple things. Ready? Let's start with passage 23, and I quote. Okay, here's a big one. This is one that that people will use to say, I should eat anything that's put before me. Are you ready? Here we go. All things are lawful, but not all things are profitable. All things are lawful, but not all things edify. Let no one seek his own good, but for that of his neighbor. Eat anything that's sold in the meat market without asking questions for conscience sake. for the earth is the Lord's and all it contains. If one of the unbelievers invites you and you want to go, eat anything that is set before you without asking questions for conscience sake. Okay, that's a big one, right? If you don't understand what a disputable matter is, what an abomination is, you don't understand all the things that we've already even discussed in this one program here, you might think that, oh, guess what? Anything's lawful. I can do whatever I want. I can eat any mark, any meat that I want. But let's go back, like we did in the previous section. We went back and we read a little bit earlier in the letter. We saw how that was plucked out and used out of context. So let's go back. We're going to go back in 1 Corinthians 10. We're going to actually go to 18 and 22. Listen to this. And I quote, "Look at the nation, Israel. Are not those who eat the sacrifices sharers in the altar? What do I mean then? That a thing sacrificed to idols is anything? Or that an idol is anything? No, but I say that the things which the Gentiles sacrificed, they sacrificed to demons and not to God. And I do not want you to become sharers in demons. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot partake in the table of the Lord and the table of demons. Or do we provoke the Lord to jealousy? We are not stronger than he, are we?" Go on to verse 23. "All things are lawful, but not all things are profitable. All things are lawful, but not all things edify. Let no one seek his own, but that of his neighbor. Eat anything that is sold in the meat market without asking questions for conscience sake." Okay, so do you see, do you hear that now? Two words, it's the same passages, but now that you understand about the disputable matter and the meat and we're going back, does that help you? Okay, now I'm going to skip through where we already read just to not belabor that point. Let's get on to verse 29. And this is what he says. Oh, actually, let me read the last line here, 28. "But if anyone says to you, this meat is sacrificed to idols, don't eat it for the sake of the one who informed you and for conscience sake. I mean, not your own conscience, but the other man's. For why is my freedom judged by another's conscience? If I partake with thankfulness, why am I slandered concerning that for which I give thanks? Whether then you eat or drink or whatever you do, do to the glory of God. Give no offense either to Jews or to Greeks or to the church of God. But just as I plead all men in all things, not seeking my own profit, but the profit of the many that they may be saved." Okay, so let's go back. The topic being addressed is food, which is properly defined as clean meats, right? Having been sacrificed to idols, to little g gods, right? That's what these meats that were clean were sacrificed to. So like that in our world, it's like they took a chicken and they dedicated it to a little g god, right? That's how we could think about it. So this was not about whether it was an unclean animal. It was about what words were spoken over it. So it's not about should we eat a poisonous blue dart frog because we are free and it's lawful to do so. Well, obviously not. That would not be good. It's what he's saying is about the conscience. Okay, he's talking about conscience. And this was something that was rampant and was even present in the segment that we read in Romans, right? That there were people that would only eat vegetables. They did not want to run into that. Even if it was a clean chicken or whatever it was that they were eating, if it was spoken to as a sacrifice to a little g god, they wanted no part of it. They were like, no. So Paul says in this letter, if we go to in 1 Corinthians 2:15-34, "Sober up to righteousness and stop sinning, for not all have the knowledge of God. I speak to your shame." So the sin, according to the Bible, as we've proven, is to disobey the Torah. That's even in that same letter. So this isn't about the dietary laws and arguing them and challenging them. Okay? So if you have that faulty reasoning that Paul's saying to eat unclean now, you're actually opening the door for all kinds of other sin. And there's really no theological position against it if you're already making that claim. So very important. We just want you to explain. I just want you to understand that you're opening a Pandora's box when you buy into dispensationalism. Very, very important. So let's just look. First of all, I want to look at this all things are lawful situation because there's actually an addition we have to remove in the translation because it has affected people. So let's read verse 23. All things are lawful for me, but all things are not expedient. I'm reading another version here. All things are lawful for me, but all things edify not. No one should seek your own. And the word good is added there. But the good of others. The word good was added. It's in italics. I read another version here. I had handy because I wanted to show you the difference of how that sounds. So no one of himself shall see, but that of another. So the word good is nowhere to be found. So good implies a judgment of right or wrong. This is about conscience. Okay, so this is very interesting. This is not a right or wrong issue. This is a seeking of the benefit of others on a neutral issue. So the word good implies a judgment or a right or a wrong. Did you see that? So adding the word good implies something. So if we're backing up to verse 23, did you notice something that's really glaringly evident? I wanted to make that point about the word good being added because it was important. But did you see that Paul says that all things are lawful? Okay, all things. If you look at that, actually look at the word, all things. It actually translates as all complete, thoroughly, with no exceptions, things. So he's saying all things are lawful. So he doesn't say he says some things, right? Think of so many things that are wrong. Like, is it lawful to drink blood? Is it lawful to rape people? No. And in that same letter, he says, let not sin therefore reign in your mortal body, in verse 12, that ye shall obey it in the lust thereof, neither yield ye your members as instruments of unrighteousness unto sin. Yield yourself unto God. He talks about the righteousness to God. But now it's telling the people, the Corinthians, that everything's allowed. So in the letter to Romans we just read, he talks about don't sin. Let your body sin. But now he's telling the people in Corinth that anything's allowed because it's all lawful. So we have to ask ourselves the question, are all things lawful, right? Okay, here is a really interesting thing to know. That all things are lawful was actually a first century slogan in Corinth that Paul actually did not agree with. So you're not going to read question marks and sarcasm in the Bible. But it's there because the punctuation was added and we don't understand the tone, especially when we're reading through a filter. So this is a slogan, all things are lawful, that Paul is quoting and he's refuting. Now, if you understand that that's a slogan, and if you actually read it, there's a book written by Winter, and it's called After Paul Left Corinth. I think it's Winter. The slogan in question is actually, some people say it's like Gnosticism, but if you read a little further in this book that I read, After Paul Left Corinth, it's very interesting. It talks about first century Platonic anthropology, which is like sort of a hedonism, a philosophical hedonism, and social conventions. You can find that in that book. They talk about how the body was designed for pleasure and that nothing that the body did could harm the soul. And that was really more of a secular belief in ancient Corinth. This was actually something that you'll find when you read up on that culture. And then if you read about Gnosticism, this was basically teaching that a matter is basically inherently evil, that matter, like anything that's physical, is just evil on its merit, and that anything spirit is inherently good, no matter what. So it's kind of like a extreme relativism, I would guess, that some people think that applies to, because both of those things were a part of ancient Corinth. So, but these beliefs of things were the prevailing doctrine that were driving factors in how these people viewed sin in this region. Does that make sense? So, you know, if you worshiped a pagan god, right, that was all about punishment and self-mutilation, you're going to have trouble reading about a god that says, don't hurt yourself and just follow me and I'm going to show you how to prosper. There are going to be people that are going to abuse you and wound you in my namesake, and you will suffer because people can be terrible. But he doesn't guide us into that. Okay, that's what we do. We experience at the hands of man. So the secular-minded people of Corinth, you know, they leaned on these philosophies because they validated their lawless lives, right? And he's talking to these people that wanted to be validated in these beliefs that were entrenched in the region. So how can these two things be true? We're looking at sentences in the same paragraph, okay? Because we did a verse plucking. We just took out all is lawful, right? So let's see. How are the, in verse 12, how is this true? All things are lawful for me, but not all things are profitable. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be mastered by anything. And verse 9, a couple of verses before that. Do not be deceived, neither fornicators, nor idolaters, or adulterers, or effeminate, or homosexuals, thieves, or the covetous, nor drunkards, nor revelers, nor swindlers will inherit the kingdom of God. So how is all lawful, but those things still be sins? Okay, that occurs in the same paragraph. So if you read it backwards, you would even see how more ridiculous that sounds. I'm not going to read it, but that's a scholarly way that people can sometimes approach information is to read something up and then down. And then down and then up, and then you are able to get a big picture. But Paul repeats this slogan from earlier in the letter. So he's repeating what the Corinthians' view was. This was the slogan. All things are lawful for me, right? That was their slogan. That's what they said. Hey, all things are lawful for me. You know how we say all's well that ends well, and no matter what we did to somebody, how mean it was, it ended up having a good fruit in the end for that person somehow, so all's good, all's well that ends well. Well, it wasn't well because it harmed your relationship with the Father, and just because something good came out of it doesn't mean you should have done it. So the Corinthians' view, all things are lawful. Now Paul's correcting it, but all things are profitable. So he's quoting Corinth and then he's interjecting what he's saying. Why would all things be lawful if not all things are profitable when there's a God that cares about the way you live? And then he repeats the Corinthians' view again. All things are lawful for me. But he's correcting it. But I won't be mastered by anything. So if I say it's lawful for me to use addictive drugs, I'm going to be mastered by that. That will govern me. So what's interesting is that the Greek word translated as but, it actually means on the contrary. Isn't that interesting? So it shows that Paul is not agreeing with the slogan. So he's refuting the belief with common sense. He says, all things are lawful for me. On the contrary, not all things are profitable. All things are lawful for me. On the contrary, I will not be mastered by anything. He's speaking their view. He's disagreeing with it and giving the reason why. He's just defending some common sense. Interesting. Isn't that interesting? And so just that one piece of information that I just shared with you clears up that whole question in Corinthians. And actually, when we get together next time, I'm going to finish Corinthians a little bit. I'm going to tie that in with what we did in Romans 14, and then we're going to get into Acts 15 and tie that together so I can wrap up a few of these questions that people have about the dietary laws, where there were some lingering questions that the books didn't cover. The Becky Book Show is all about that. It's to bring you a little further, cover something that might not have been covered. And people have their esoteric questions. They have their ideas. And these aren't by any means esoteric because they are pretty commonly misunderstood. But it's important that we have this show to discuss these things so that maybe you can have an answer for your friends and family. And maybe you hadn't gone to the scope that we went when discussing this topic. But that's what the Becky Book Show is about. We want to have a Becky book for your questions. We want to have a Becky book for your family. We don't want you to have to recreate the wheel and write your own book. We're doing that for you. We're putting the effort and the time in. We're making it very inexpensive for you to share. And we're making it a short read. Some of them are longer than others, but that's what our goal is. Just to provide you with help provide you help so that you can go ahead and hand something out in a way that's non-threatening, helpful, and that people can be delivered from their questions, their doubt, and their pain and fear. So I really hope today was helpful to you. I wish we could have finished it all, but you know, you always think 2 hours is enough time, and it never is, because there's just things you need to kind of delve into a little bit more and go off track a little bit, because even a question in your own mind pops up, and that's just how these shows can be. But we're in the flow of spirit. We're in the flow of how we're sharing this information with you, and we just want to be a help to you. So you can reach me by going to www.dowcovenantpath.com. I'm Dr. Rob Gould. You can go onto Amazon.com and type in BEKY books, and the Becky books will pop up. You'll find topics like the Sabbath, truth, tradition, or care, the book about the Jewish sources, about how to celebrate the new moon, all kinds of different Hanukkah book. I mean, you name it. There's all kinds of different topics, divorce. So, you know, don't be shy about getting resources. This is what they're there for. They're there to help you and to help people that you love. I really enjoyed our time together today. I enjoyed sharing with you some of the things that have come up in emails. And I hope if you were a person that sent a letter, that maybe some of your questions got answered today. And I look forward to hearing from you. If you buy a Becky book and you read it, please leave a review. They help very much when we're when these things are popping up in Amazon for people. The more good reviews they get, the more that they kind of permeate the system. So let's try to get that going. We're going to finish this talk about Paul, Corinthians, and what's being said and what he meant, and how it shows humanity is very similar today. I'm a therapist, so I like to go into the behavior and mindset. It's fun to do that. But anyway, we're about out of time today. I've enjoyed talking with you and sharing with you, and I hope you have a wonderful week, and return next week as we finish our study here on the dietary laws. And hope you have a wonderful, blessed week. I hope your Thanksgiving was wonderful and that you feel rested and refreshed. It's been a wonderful return to the air to share with you and encourage you. So I bid you a wonderful shalom and hope to see you again soon.